everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan, Professor Zay, Anthropologist, Sachs. And if you don't recognize that magic card, dear listeners, Professor Zay, Anthropologist, is from Avatar The Last Airbender. Is it for an 03 legendary creature, tap, discard a card, draw a card. One tap, sacrifice Professor Zay. Return target instant or sorcery card from your graveyard to your hand. Activate only once during your turn. And why, after Avatar is gone, am I introducing our dear Ethan as Professor Zay?
I mean, this is perhaps one of your most inspired introductions we've ever had. But yes, this is because I am attempting to have us embark on a 10-part anthropological experience here on the podcast in our hiatus from the main set of Turtles, with a deep dive on all of the 10 archetypes in Magic and as they relate to Limited. So we'll see how it goes, but I'm excited for the prospect of this deep dive, this archaeological dig that we're going on.
Yeah, you put on your Indiana Jones hat and hit the 17 lands data and did some digging. Took one for the team.
I did. Well, I mean, and I know that that's what people come here for. That's what we're known for, is just mining the data and putting out a good output from it. But in all seriousness, I think this will just be a fun discussion about the archetypes in Limited as sort of like as archetypes, like what do they archetypically do? And then we're going to look at, for each archetype, as we do this series, we're going to look at what sets in the Playboost era has it been successful in, and what sets has it not been successful in?
And why not? And hopefully try to draw some conclusions about what to be on the lookout for from future sets to, you know, help inform, do we think this archetype is going to hit or not?
Yeah, because I think we've hinted at that. And I think you and I have some things we look for. But signposts, I think, has been a big one for us. Like, you know, if there's two signposts for an archetype and they both look like they're going to hit, we often, you know, will put a foot forward of saying, I think that one's going to have more legs than not. And that's not always the case. And I think there's more to that puzzle. And, you know, we may find that, like, I'm not trying to draw conclusions from three sets or six sets or whatever. But I think it'll just be a good discussion for us to talk about. Here's what we feel like Blue-Red usually does. Spoiler, that's what we're doing this episode, is Blue-Red. Here's what we feel like Blue-Red usually does. Or here's what we feel like it gets. Or this is what we feel like we want to look out for. And that sort of thing. So I'm excited to dive in. But in classic Lords of Limited fashion, I feel like we're going to get to the main episode like 40 minutes into the content, because we got some other fun stuff at the top of the show notes today.
Heck yeah, we do, which is 9 cards that made me, the things going around Twitter and things going around Blue Sky. Are we doing that now? Pre-tease?
Let's do some housekeeping. Let's go in the order we got stuff here. So first up, we'll chat about the Patreon page, patreon.com/lordsoflimited. It's where folks can go to give back to the show. The show will always be free, but we have some great perks via the Patreon. One is access to our Discord, which is just an excellent community of other Limited fanatics like yourself. And higher up on the reward tier rankings of Patreon gets you access to our podcast feed, where you'll not only get this episode a day early ad free, but you also get our weekly bonus episode of Lords Unlimited. You can also do a free trial of that, like a week free trial of the podcast feed, see how that fits into your life. You can also, I never shout this out, but it's just a great deal that, like, there are deals at Patreon in terms of if you sub for like a year, if you're like, I know I'm going to support these guys, or if you are currently supporting the show and you're not doing this, this just saves you money in terms of going and saying, hey, I'm going to just get a year subscription rather than do it monthly. And that gives you a little discount there, which is an awesome perk that Patreon does. So shouting out all of those things, shouting out our Patreon, shouting out our new patrons each week that they join. So this week we're welcoming Felix, Charlie, and Benjamin. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, I cannot say thank you enough. Benjamin, good strong name there at the end.
There it is. Okay, let's do a little Turtles update. We are not going to be doing, we did say game over last week, and I think we're going to stick with it. No continues being clicked on the Turtles NES game here. But we played. I played probably half a dozen pick one drafts this week. Ben, what about you?
I've also done 3 pick one drafts, not because I was particularly interested. Mostly, actually, I did the first one because people in the Discord were like, oh, pick one seems okay. Like, it's better than I was expecting, whatever. And I wanted to check it out, do my due diligence as a content creator. And I do agree that pick one felt way better than pick two. Like that felt is like just
actually like, drafting, kind
yes.
of. Yeah.
Yes.
As so much pick, of an endorsement as that sounds like. But.
Pick two is officially dead on board for me. Like it was noticeably better in pick two. That being said, here's still my beef with turtles, or not that beef, but just why I'm uninterested, is that it's just all a reskin of everything. Like I think if they give us one of these small sets that has some new mechanics, then I will start to be interested. Assuming it is small, new mechanics, pick one, that I would give a chance to. I think if they're going to keep reskinning old mechanics and reskinning old cards, that feels so tough to me. Like this, the format doesn't give me personally, and if you are enjoying Turtles, don't let me yuck your yum, but the format doesn't give me personally what I want from Magic, which is a new exciting experience every time a new set comes out. And this just feels like an old set in new clothes to me.
Yes. The big thing for me is that I just felt like I was making zero decisions. I felt like in draft, in deck building, in gameplay, I was just like, what is my default? What is my heuristic that I rely on for these decisions? And I just made that. And that's not very fun for me. Like people saying that, like, I saw people like, the gameplay is actually good. That did not track for me at all. I found the gameplay extremely rote and often decided by bombs. And I don't know if you saw this. Did you see the, like, they did mess up like the pack collation or whatever, that like mythics and rares were more represented than they should have been?
Yes.
They should have never leaked that information, because we are going to be dealing with the repercussions of that from pack truthers for years to come.
I will say,
so not looking forward to that. No, go ahead.
I will say I still have not looked at all of the rares and mythics. So like, as I've been playing drafts, I keep like seeing new cards, you know, as Garfield intended. Someone yesterday played a black 8-drop with flash that killed 3 of my creatures on ETB. Like, how is that a real Magic card?
I'll tell you what I find, the card that surprised me the most was, I think it's Agent Bishop. It's 2 and a white for a 1/2 at the beginning of combat. You put a +1 counter on each of up to 2 target creatures. Is it just like Luminarch Aspirant x2 or whatever? How is this fair? I was just like, wait, what? You get to do what? So crazy.
Have you played against the Madam So-and-So Power Broker card yet?
Is that the 1/3 Death Touch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So curving that into Pachyderm, you just get, an 8/8 trample on turn 4.
Yeah.
There are a lot of dumb rares in Turtles. Yeah, but there are some good things. I do love Omni Cheese Pizza. Like, I'm glad that a new generation is getting to experience
the golden
egg. Incredible Golden Egg is, because it's still amazing. But the bummer for me was, like, the cool thing about Golden Egg the first time around was, oh, this is way more impactful than it looks. Like, let me draft it higher and let me start playing with it more and then getting that reward. And this time I saw Omni Cheese Pizza, I didn't realize it was the Golden Egg, but realized it had very similar characteristics. Didn't quite put together that they were exactly the same. And then I just get to play with it now, which is less satisfying than discovering that it's cool in the first place, you know?
And it's not like context doesn't matter, because it very much does, as we will see when we look at do this sort of like archetype deep dive thing that's going to be this episode series. Context matters, but more so what matters, and more so what is fun as a puzzle to solve. And someone in our Discord mentioned this. They were like, that like Magic is at its best when it's a puzzle to solve. And what I felt like, I was like, I don't really feel like I have a puzzle to solve right now, which was making me feel a little sad. But just turning a little knob on these, you know, sort of mainstay designs, like a golden egg or something, if you just tweak a little knob on that somewhere on the text of the card, it makes it a more fun puzzle for us to figure out. Because like, oh, this is kind of like something I've seen before, but not quite. Plus context matters is going to make that more of a mystery than just being like, here's a golden egg, but it's pizza this time.
Well, but that's why the new mechanics like help so much, because they add that layer of mystery. Like that I think is the biggest thing that's missing for me, because we had so much of the context going in because we knew the power level of all of the mechanics, and we played like, archetypes patterned after those mechanics before.
Right. It's like, okay, well, I know what you need for sneak. You need like you need the cheap enablers, you need the good payoffs, and okay.
Like, for example, if a set comes out and they reskin Final Fantasy mechanics and they re-rack the Blazinga, Blazaga, whatever, we're going to know, a one drop that scales is going to be like, to kind of segue into our episode here. Oh, also, I will say the last Turtles update, the pizza thing is real. Like Omni Cheese and the everything pizza and like the goopy 3-5 color soup stuff. That's real.
I bet that's more real in pick one than it is in pick two.
Pick two is not real. So,
well, pick two is not real and it can't hurt me is what Ben is saying. But yes, I agree that it's not real. But I think in pick two, you're just so incentivized to be one of those
archetypes and just stand your flag. Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. March includes International Women's Day, a moment to celebrate women's strength and progress while also recognizing how much they carry every day.
Between caring for others and managing unseen responsibilities, their emotional well-being can easily be overlooked. We want to remind women how much they matter and that therapy offers a space for them to take care of themselves in a way they deserve.
My wife is literally carrying a massive responsibility right now in the form of our unborn second child. I was going to say that it was also unseen, but I mean, in a way it's unseen, but in a way it's quite seen. But truly, every day, she's like 24 weeks pregnant. You can tell. Every day I am in awe of her navigating her job, us purchasing a new house, our relentless toddler, all while being pregnant.
We're sure that either you yourself or the women in your life are juggling the various roles they play, the expectations placed on them, and the pressure they feel. Therapy can help create balance, set health boundaries, and support overall well-being for everyone.
With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and if you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from our tailored recs.
Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/lords.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/lords. And now, back to the show. We'll be doing a full deep dive tournament recap on Team Sealed, which is what I'm going to the Shoebox tournament in St. Paul next weekend. I did a little Team Sealed prep this weekend, both in paper with some buddies and online with my teammates, Sam and Charlie. And for anyone out there who is doing Team Sealed, not only for, so there's Shoebox next weekend, but then there is also a Team Sealed spotlight in June, I believe, in Vegas. And Draftmancer has a Team Sealed version.
Correct.
Which it's really cool. I had not used it before, where like all three people can see the same pool and you all like can claim the cards up top and then build your deck at the bottom. So we were all like sharing our screens and being like, all right, you build elves, you build merfolk. And then we could look at, and then you would sort of do what you do in paper, which is like, if someone grabbed this card and you're like, actually, can I have that? Then they have to like unclick it and you go grab it for your deck. And it was fun. The format will be Lorwyn Eclipse, which I'm very grateful for, but also Lorwyn Eclipse it's a very interesting Team Sealed format. I've done 6 pools so far, and 4 of them, there's an elves deck, there's a merfolk deck. And then the big question mark is, what do you do with deck 3?
Yeah. Vivid, baby.
Yeah. Well, except like so many of our pools, just you didn't get the payoffs. Like, if you don't have the Kith Keepers or the Prisma Bashers, it's hard to be like, I'm going to justify putting all these hybrid cards in here for no value, you know?
Yeah, you basically have to play elves, right?
I don't think I've seen a pool without elves.
I wonder if there's a world where like you could do elves, split the black, do white black, and then do elementals. Is that ever a better?
It really just depends baseline on
elves and merfolk, because red's so weak on its own. You know what I mean? Like if you do elves, if you do merfolk, like red is a tough sell with everything left over.
It really just depends on what your uncommon payoffs are. Like if you have like 2 Eclipsed Marrows and 2 Deep Channel Duelists, you've got to build merfolk.
Oh, I have so much FOMO about Shoebox.
It'll be fine. It's very exciting that there is a Team Sealed or Team Limited event on the Spotlight Series schedule this year, because I feel like that means there's likely to be more in the future.
Yeah.
Okay. 9 cards that made me is this I don't know. Yeah, this thing sweeping the online discourse, which is basically just a nostalgia trip, right? An opportunity for people to reference 9 cards that are important to their Magic history.
Yeah, it's the Magic player equivalent of like dudes sitting around naming old sports players and just being happy naming old sports players.
Yes. So I saw this floating around and I was like, we should do this on the show. I think it'll be fun. And then you threw in the wrinkle of we got to try and guess. So what is the way to do this? Is it I try and guess yours, or should we just say our, like, you say your list and then I say, because I have my list of cards I'm gonna guess from you, and then do we just say like, yes, I got 4 of those? Or
I think we should guess first and just say, okay, yes or no, and then reveal the ones that weren't guessed.
Okay,
I'm going first on you.
Okay,
are you ready? Mm-hmm. I feel very good about my first choice, which is balance.
Okay, yes, the art is on the wall, balance is there, that is for sure.
Okay.
Do I do story time first, or like?
Oh,
like,
sure. Yeah.
Talk about why this card is important.
Yes. Yeah, we should do that.
So balance is 1 and a white sorcery, and you balance out from each player the amount of lands, creatures, and cards in hand that they have. Everybody goes down to the minimum. And this is sort of representative of a cube style deck that I really like, which back in the day I think was really like white red art. Like you'd have like your artifact ramp, you'd have balance, you'd have wildfire. Like it would sort of be a white red control deck. But oof, balance,
wildfire is such a good one for me. Didn't put that on my list.
Balance is sort of also a stand in for maybe some other cards of like cards that I don't understand upon reading. That like I lose 2 and then a light bulb goes off and you go, oh, it does that. I want to do that. And then you make that your identity. I know, I'm sure balance is also, I'm seeing on the wall behind you, I would imagine balance is also on your list.
Balance is also on my list. I have loved balance. I think you and I bonded over a mutual love of balance in cube. Like balance to me at this point is a representative of my love for cube and also the podcast. Like balance, yeah, I think was my favorite Magic card and has only grown stronger since starting the podcast.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Guess number 2, Dovin's Acuity.
Yes. Dovin's Acuity is on this list. This is 1 white blue for an enchantment. When it enters, you gain 2 life and draw a card. And whenever you cast an instant spell during your main phase, you can return Dovin's Acuity to its owner's hand. This was from Ravnica Allegiance. There was like a loops deck in this format that I feel like I discovered. I feel like I was championing this deck and this card early. I got to draft this in my first draft at day 2 of a GP for this format. This is a stand-in for like all of the loop style cards that I have been attracted. I was like, Epitaph Golem was on my like honorable mentions list, but I felt like Dovin's Acuity sort of encapsulated that ethos for me.
All right, number 3, Sailor of Means.
Yeah, Sailor of Means, 2 and a blue, 1/4. When it enters, make a treasure token. This was in Ixalan and then Rivals of Ixalan, but in Ixalan, the real ones were drafting Sailor of Means in Ixalan because then it was actually good in Rivals of Ixalan, which was kind of disappointing. Sailor of Means was like my sort of peak meme drafter era, where I was drafting these like 4 and 5 color monstrosity decks in a very aggressive format and like would be thrilled when I would 2-1 and that felt like a trophy. Also trying to do like Toughness Matters stuff with the Selesnya dinosaur. And so then Sailor of Means is a 3-mana 4/4 and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, a fun card.
Do you think about that? We had sets for so long back then that we were quite happily doing podcast episodes on, here's this offbeat stuff you can do that's really cool and fun. And if you 2-1, you feel like a god.
Yep. I wonder how those would be met today. But we don't have the time. We don't have the time. Blink and you'll miss the sets these days.
Okay. I felt very confident about those 3. After
those 3
that,
are good.
It gets a lot harder. I'm going to throw out Jury, Master of the Review.
No, but you're in the ballpark.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw out Mayhem Devil also.
No, I put a Rakdos card as the stand-in.
What is the Rakdos card you chose?
Mayhem Devil probably should be it, except that like you didn't actually draft that kind of deck in War of the Spark where Mayhem Devil was printed. I chose Disturbing Mirth from Duskmourn, the black-red enchantment.
Okay.
Because I feel like that was maybe the best Rakdos Sacrifice archetype and the one that I would like felt like I was just vibing with the most. But perhaps Jury from March of the Machine, which is coming back next
week.
Well,
the reason I chose Jury was Gumption. Yeah. That was the Gumption origin.
But the reason I had an issue with Jury was it was a reprint. Right, yeah. It was on the bonus sheet, and so I was like, "Is that? I don't know." I had weird internal struggles with picking that, but Jury's a good shout because of Gumption. Yeah.
Okay. Then I've got Karuga.
Yorion is on my list. Ultimately, is the one I chose. Karuga is a good one because, and it's just you have to put a companion here. I had Lurrus for a minute, and then I was like, Lurrus doesn't feel right. Lurrus is too mainstream at this.
That's
point.
That's what I decided. I want Karuga for the secret twos. I will never not see Karuga and not think secret twos.
Well, and Karuga I companioned Karuga in the constructed deck that I played for Arena Championship 5. That like combo deck that was about the discover mechanic. And so I think I should have done that because you're never going to guess this. I did put Doomsday Excruciator on my list as like a Ooh. Nod to my like most recent sort of feeling of leveling up in my constructed life with like picking and piloting and picking the sort of specific cards for that tournament for that deck. But Karuga is a good one too.
Okay. So the Sky Noodle, are you going to talk about your bond?
I love companions. It is like my favorite limited mechanic of all time. I love the sort of like, it's clear, here's your build around. And if you do it, you get a clear reward. And Yorion, I think, is very much a me card in terms of like, I'm just always like, I just feel like I know now. I'm like, well, this is what you have to do. You can't pick lands when you're drafting Yorion because you're never going to make playables. And I just love that challenge of like, can I get to 32, 33 playables so I can companion Yorion? I love companions. I don't know what to say. I'm very excited for March of the Machine coming back in a week because companions are there.
Last, I had several companions on my guesses for you, so that makes it harder. Last remaining card is Improbable Alliance. Which is the blue red enchantment?
Oh, from Eldraine, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a good look that I don't have an Eldraine card on my list.
Wow.
It's not a good look. Improbable, I wonder what it would be. Improbable Alliance isn't bad. I mean, if I'm picking a card from Eldraine, it's Golden Egg. That would be the card
fair.
I would pick.
Yeah.
But I have a different
card
that is the sort of, it's the grandfather of the Golden Egg before the Golden Egg, which is Skittering Surveyor.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I can't believe I didn't get that one. That's embarrassing. That's on me.
And so then rounding out two other cards. So we've got Sailor of Means Balance, Surveyor, Acuity, Yorion, Disturbing Mirth, and Doomsday Excruciator. I have a card representative of my childhood of Magic, which is White Knight. It's white okay. for 2/2 pro black first strike. I had good taste in
Magic cards as a kid. That's a banger.
I had a mono white deck. My friend had a mono black deck, and those were like the decks who would face off against each other. My brother had this like really good white weenie deck with like Tundra Wolves and Crusade and White Knights and like Savannah Lions. And I was always very in awe of that deck. And so White Knight was sort of formative for me. And the last card on my list is Renin 6 as a nod to my love of the like tier two Jund land, like 2-for-1s, mid-range, Crucible of Worlds land garbage in cube that I was like real. I'm not really into it that much these days, but there was like a good 3-year pocket where I was like, I'm never drafting blue in cube and I'm only drafting this Jund garbage. And Renin 6, I feel like, is emblematic there.
Plus, you had to put at least partially a green card on the list. So the
I did. As I was looking at it was very surprising to me. So 6 of my 9 cards are Azorius, or 5 of my 9 cards are Azorius. One is an artifact. But yeah, I almost was like, should I just not put a green card on the list to be very, very Lords of Limited coded? But I decided to have all colors represented. Okay, for you, Bath Song was the first card I thought of.
Bath Song is on my list, yeah. I am, as my nod to enjoying loops and making the game go long, and I loved Lord of the Rings. I think Bath Song is the build around that I have felt the strongest about as far as uncommon build arounds go, and Give me a Bath song and I will happily play it.
Cursed Recording?
It is not on the list. I chose a different 4-mana enchantment.
Source. Oh, 4-mana enchantment.
Yeah.
Oh, so is Sorceress's Skins not on your list?
No, it is not.
So a stand-in for all of these sort of
a stand-in for all those sort of cards. The OG. The OG.
I don't remember.
From your format.
From my format? What's my format? Is Eldraine?
Eldraine.
Oh, Fires of Invention, of course.
Yeah. Yes, Fires of Invention. So Fires of Invention is 3 and a red. You can only cast spells during your turn, and you can cast no more than 2 spells each turn. But you can cast spells for free if their mana value is less than the number of lands that you have. And I argued so vehemently for this card.
You did.
When we did our thing.
Yeah.
I saw the vision, and then the vision worked. And I have since fallen in love with. This one was actually extremely good.
Oh.
And the others that I've fallen in love with have been of varying power levels.
I don't have this on my list, but I'm going to guess it. Is Wilderness Reclamation on your list?
No, but that's a good shout.
Okay.
It's a good shout. Should be on my list.
And I have on my list the Golden Egg because I thought that you would put it on, but how you responded when I mentioned it for my list made me think that you did not have it on
it
your
list. It
is
not on my list. No, not on my list.
Okay. I wanted to put something from Ikoria, which is your goat set. So it could be, no Ikoria cards?
No Ikoria cards.
Wow, no Eldraine, no Eldraine for me, no Ikoria for you. That's crazy. Okay.
I thought about Zenith Flare, but I don't feel like Zenith Flare made me.
No, I feel like I had Bushmeat Poacher or Whisper Squad as my guesses for you.
Bushmeat Poacher, I think, would be the one if I picked one.
And the only other card I have on my list I feel like is balance is a stand-in for is Upheaval.
No, I put actual factual balance.
Yeah, I know. But so I feel
Yeah. I thought about Upheaval.
Yeah. Upheaval is a great card too, but I feel like balance represents what Upheaval represents.
Correct. I had Upheaval and then I had to cut it because there just was no room. So Upheaval was on the short list.
So I only got, what did I get? 3? Did I even get 3?
You got 2.
I get 2? No, I'll take my
I told you had a chance at, you really only probably had a chance at 6. I told you 7.
Okay.
So Writhing Chrysalis, 2 red green for the 2/3.
You're sick.
ATBs, make 2 Eldrazi spawn tokens, reach, and whenever you sacrifice another Eldrazi, put a +1/+1 counter on it. As a nod to my hatred of 17 lands data, and I was pretty outspoken against Writhing Chrysalis.
Okay.
I think that started the whole, I think that really amped up the whole mad discourse.
That was our first cold open. I mean, we've only done 2.
That was our first cold open. I just have fond memories of that card.
Of raging against people loving that card. Okay, cool.
I'm sick. What can I say?
You are sick. I don't think I ever would have guessed that card, really, for you. But that's a good one. Okay.
I've got Clear the Mind.
Okay.
2 blue, target player shuffles their graveyard into their library, draw a card. I just remember feeling like my opponent cast 1, like my first game, and I remember thinking, I don't know if they had a second one of these and could loop them if I could beat them. Mm-hmm. And then we had talked about that on the podcast. And then like that deck kind of sprung in and you sprinkled the Dovin's Acuity in there and we were off to the races.
Yeah. So Clear the Mind is a 2 and a blue sorcery, shuffle your graveyard into your library, draw a card.
Yeah.
And that was you get 2 of those in a Dovin's Acuity deck and you just can never deck because you always loop them back in. That was, I remember, I think I had like discarded 1. This is like in a round at the GP where I was playing this deck. Had discarded 1, and then my opponent thought seized the other one out of my hand. And I just like thought for a second and I was like, we gotta go to game 3. Like I can't win. I can't win, and I don't know what we're gonna waste. Like my deck already eats the clock for the round in such an aggressive way that I was like, I don't think it's responsible of me to keep playing this game. Okay.
Squire's Devotion.
Yes, that's on my list.
It's on your list.
It's above. I can show you in my note, Doc.
I trust you.
It's above that song. I don't know how I missed it. Yes, Squire's Devotion is on here. Okay.
2 and a white aura enchant creature. Enchanted creature gets +1/+1 and has lifelink. And when Squire's Devotion enters the battlefield, you make a 1/1 white vampire creature token with lifelink. This to me is representative of early podcast times and when we were, I think, trying to break formats with the podcast community pre-data, and we came out with our Avoiding the Aggro Trap episode. Like, I feel like that was a good first iconic early podcast episode because everybody else was still trying to do all of the aggressive stuff from Ixalan, but the format, I think, had slowed down and had favored trying to stop the aggro decks.
Yeah, avoiding the aggro trap. One of your great early episodes to sort of like be like, this is what the format is about on like week one. Really, really good.
Good clickbait title too. It was great.
Yeah. Before there was clickbait. No, not really.
And then balance is on here, as we already alluded to. And then three constructed-ish cards. So Shivan Dragon as first rare I ever opened from childhood.
Nice, nice.
And then, much like your White Knight, I have Fairy Noble on my list. Shout out to Homelands. This is two and a green for a 1/2 flying Fairy Noble. Actually, it's not even a fairy. It's a noble. All fairies you control get +0/+1, and you can tap it to give all fairies you control +1/+0 until end of turn. So I needed a tribal deck. It was like your thing with your brother. Like one of my brothers had an absolute banger goblin deck, and the other one had an absolute banger merfolk deck. And there were no more tribes left. And yeah. So I was like, what's left for me? And I made fairies my thing to try to hang with my brother's tribal decks. I still have the cards in a box.
Trying to make fairies happen pre-Lorwyn is impressive.
Yeah. It was blue-green. It was great. Had some unstable mutations to put on my scribe sprites, etc. I understood tempo as a child. Unstable mutations, giant growths. Sneak those wins. And then the last card is, this is one that I doubt anyone would ever guess, except maybe my brothers, which is Cosmic Larva. This is one red for a 7/6 trample from Fifth Dawn. And at the beginning of your upkeep, sacrifice Cosmic Larva unless you sacrifice two lands. So this was, I played Constructed like quite a bit when I was in high school, like maybe my sophomore year of high school, got back into Magic, and this was like the Ravager Affinity era. And so my brothers and I and a couple of my friends from high school, we all went PTQing, but we didn't have enough copies of Arcbound Ravager because it was like $80 for everybody to play Ravager Affinity. So we were trying to build decks and brew decks that could beat Ravager Affinity.
Okay.
And so one of the brews that we came up with that only one of us played that probably all of us should have played was this Cosmic Larva Screaming Fury combo deck. Screaming Fury is a common. It's 2 and a red sorcery. Target creature gets +5/+0 and haste until end of turn. So it was like the Splinter Twin type deals with like Vampire or whatever. You would try to get to 6, cast Cosmic Larva, Screaming Fury it. Then you'd crack in for 12 trample. And then you could untap and sacrifice two lands for a couple turns and have your 7/6 around. And then it just played like you just dumped on Affinity with artifact hates and shatters and shatter storms and whatever. It was a sweet brew. And my brother Adam actually top aided the PTQ with this Cosmic Larva deck that we brewed up.
That's pretty sick.
Yeah,
that's pretty sick.
So those are my 9 cards.
Yeah, this is a fun exercise. Would recommend to folks out there, and especially if you're in the Discord. Put them together, throw them in the Discord chat, the recent episode discussions. We'd love to see them. All right, we're going to talk about blue-red. And we have, luckily, on the podcast, one of the foremost blue-red mages in Limited to give us a rundown of what this archetype historically does. Whether it does those things well, we'll sort of dig into in a little bit. But what is blue-red historically known for doing?
I love a good blue-red deck. Think this, yes. Is it mage? You're what? If you have to pick a color pair, what are you?
I guess I'm Rakdos these days.
Okay, Rakdos. That makes sense. Because I like when I think you, I think Jund. And I was trying to narrow it down to two. Yeah, Rakdos is what you are. Yeah. So blue-red as a limited archetype. And then the first thing that comes to mind is spells matter, right? So like and I don't feel like we've gotten this much in the last like 2 or 3 years, really in the play booster era. Mm-hmm. But the blue-red decks that trying to play cantrips, you're trying to play cheap interaction, you're trying to play spells, basically, that are going to grow creatures that get benefits or payoffs from counting the number of spells in your graveyard, or maybe they get +1/+1 counters when you cast spells, or really, I think the most iconic or my favorite spells matter blue-red decks are ones that count the number of spells in your graveyard, like that give you Rise from the Tides, for example, is 5 and a blue sorcery. Make 2/2s or make 2/2s equal to the number of spells in your graveyard.
Yeah, and we've seen like I don't know, we'll mostly just be looking at play booster sets, but you can think of stuff like Enigma Drake or Cackling Drake or those sorts of like. And we just had this actually in Avatar. One of the signposts was the what was it called? The Dragonfly Swarm, the like star 3, 1 blue red for, and its power was equal to the number of of spells in your graveyard.
Yeah. So I think that is the most stereotypical blue-red, like black-green is graveyard stuff. Blue-red is spells matter in some fashion. Mm-hmm. And then if you start to hone in on how that actually plays out, tempo aggro, I think, is probably the best way that blue-red functions, where you're trying to play cheap threats that get benefits from those spells, and then use those spells to keep your opponents off balance. So you play your Otter Penguin's a bad example because that wants you to draw cards. But cards of that ilk, Sahagin, I think, is a good example. So one and a blue, 1/3, gets a +1/+1 counter if you cast something mana value 4 or greater and becomes unblockable. And you're trying to cast spells to remove your opponent's creatures and kill your opponent with the Sahagin-type creature.
Yes. Okay.
There's Control, I think, which makes the best use of, we've kind of coined this Holy Trinity phrase on the podcast of for several different things, but in terms of spells decks or blue decks, where blue gets an instant speed card draw spell, an instant speed counter spell, and an instant speed interaction spell. And so you can theoretically be holding up any of those, and then your opponent doesn't know how to play into them. They don't know whether you're holding the counter spell, and they might sandbag their best thing when you don't have the counter spell. Or maybe you do and they jam and you counter it. Or if they try to play around your counter spell, then on their end step, you can pass and draw cards. So there's, it just gives you a lot of flexibility for how to play your turn. It makes it so your opponents don't know how to play their turns. But basically, if you're playing blue-red control, you're trying to 2-for-1 your opponents to death and just have a couple good late game finishers, whether those are like common 6-drops or preferably, you know, rares, uncommons that are a little more protected than that.
And control is never really what the WotC prescribed archetype description is. I feel like blue-red as a control deck or as a control archetype is often a, and you can also do this. Would you agree with that? Or do you feel like sometimes, no, blue-red control is what blue-red does best in this format?
No, it's usually built around like some of the red enchantment payoffs, that kind of thing. Or yeah, they're usually more niche backdoor decks. Blue black is usually the one that's billed as control.
Correct. Yeah.
And then the beautiful thing about control is sometimes the control decks do dovetail with the spells matter payoffs, like Rise from the Tides, right? That wants the game to go long, or Seize the Storm is another good shout from older sets, which is 4 and a red, make an XX equal to the number of spells in your yard. So those things that count spells in your graveyard want the game to go long because you're going to have more spells in your yard the longer the game goes.
Sorceress's Schemes from Final Fantasy is another good, like, was blue-red a control deck, like, first and foremost in Final Fantasy? No. But here's a tool at Uncommon that if you get one or two of these, all of a sudden you can lean in towards, oh, maybe I'll do this other thing instead.
Correct. And then the last one that really sticks out to me from blue-red is an artifact theme, which is usually just replacing spells matter with artifacts matter. But it's the same type of thing where you're trying to grow these small things that are getting payoffs from artifacts in the battlefield, or you casting artifacts or artifacts entering the battlefield, that sort of thing. But it's basically just a different reskin of blue-red spells.
Yeah, I think the only other time we sort of had this as a reskin in the play booster era was was Duskmourn, which it wasn't artifacts matter, it was rooms matter. And so I sort of have like lumped this in as it's sort of card type matters when that card type is not an instant or sorcery.
Correct, yeah. And then the last style of deck there is a mid-range deck, and I don't think blue-red really typically gets to make mid-range decks. And in fact, one of the things that it suffers from sometimes is its cards are split. Like, there's half of blue and red's cards that really want to be a tempo aggro deck, and half of its cards that really want to be a control deck. And sometimes that can be a weakness of the color pair. Like, we'll be like, well, there's two decks here, we don't know which one's going to be better. And if we don't know which one's going to be better, sometimes neither end up being very good.
Well, and you can, when there's splits like that, I mean, coming off the heels of Lorwyn Eclipsed, I think you can feel this a lot where you're like, oh, black is open. And I started off with the Boggart champion, so I'll go into black red. And you're like, yeah, black is open, but the black cards you're seeing are elf cards, not goblin cards. And so when you have those splits in a color, when it's like, okay, half of this is tempo aggro, half of this is control, and you feel like, oh, I got this really good rare, these couple of first good picks, if the signpost is tempo aggro supported, And then all of the other cards you're seeing in blue or red are for control. You get this dissonance in your deck.
Well, it also, I think, gives the opportunity for misbuilding decks that maybe don't exist in some other more straightforward color pairs or whatever. So if you try to build your tempo aggro deck and you accidentally slot in three control cards, well, your tempo aggro deck is going to be worse. And maybe you come away with the conclusion that tempo aggro is bad in the format. But really, you just misbuilt your tempo aggro deck or vice versa for the control life.
Well, I think not only misbuilding, but also playing is going to be extremely difficult or perhaps subtly difficult for these decks. So two things. One, I did my slight due diligence in that we're veering on doing a data episode. And so I did reach out to the man himself, Serkovitz, and I was like, hey, this is like a episode series we're embarking on. Here are like the things I'm planning to look at. Is there stuff you would want to like dive into or think about that you're not seeing here? And one thing that he pointed me towards was a post that he has made in the past, which is about how top players versus bottom players, how different archetypes play to their strengths. And there's a table in our show notes that effectively all four blue decks, top players win with more. So blue-red is going to be a deck, and that's when I sorted, so we'll get into like what formats is blue-red better at than others, or better in than others. That is from sorting by top players on 17 lands. And it's just worth noting that blue decks are harder to win with for worse players than for top players. And when I was doing my paper testing for Lorwyn Eclipsed Team Sealed yesterday with some friends, they were like, you know, they had built their three decks and they were like, what do you think like the order of difficulty is for these? And I was like, definitely blue red elementals is the most difficult deck of the three that you have here. And they were sort of like, oh, like none of them had said that. And then as soon as they started playing out the decks and the blue red player was like, I was like, you've got your Gristle Gluttons looting. You've got your Flaring Cinders looting. Like everything you do is a decision. It's a decision in this deck. Yeah. And you can screw it up. And so I'm like, okay, what do I copy with Omni Changeling? What am I doubling these triggers? Whatever. Like, just blue red's got a lot. So it's not only in, ooh, deck building and did I put these aggro cards in my control deck or vice versa? But then all of a sudden you cast Opt. Oops, here's a decision already. Like, okay, you're casting Thrill of Possibility. What are you discarding? When are you casting Thrill, etc.? Like, I feel like blue-red's decision trees are vast.
For sure.
Any other thoughts about blue-red as a sort of overarching archetype?
I just have some thoughts on when it's good and when it struggles, but we're going to get into that into some of the data.
Okay, great. So we can start by looking at some various categories that I was looking at. I obviously looked at the signposts, and I guess we should start by saying, what sets are we looking at? So I looked through all the sets of the Play Booster era and looked at where blue-red ranked among top users in terms of the archetypes. And I picked blue-red first because I was like, blue-red, I feel like historically has struggled in the Play Booster era, and it has, except for recently. In three of the last four major sets, it was a top performing deck. So in Final Fantasy, it was first. In Avatar, The Last Airbender, it was first. And in Lorwyn Eclipsed, so to my surprise, actually, it was second. And so those are the sets that we're going to be looking at in terms of what can we glean from blue-red succeeding in those sets? Like what sort of ties bind between those three sets? And then where blue-red struggled, you have a lot of options. The sets that I chose were Outlaws of Thunder Junction, Foundations, and Edge of Eternities, where it performed 9th, 9th, and 8th among top users.
Yikes.
So the categories of cards that I looked at, I looked at signposts, obviously. You can see what we'll glean from all of these. Signposts. Removal, like how the colors and color pair gets to interact in terms of the removal from those colors, the counter magic, the protection spells it has, what card draw or cheap hand smoothing does it have, and some other categories that sort of stood out to me that we will get to in a little bit. I feel like the sort of surface level stuff, if we look at the three sets that we're going to look at where it flopped, Edge of Eternities, blue-red was billed as artifact aggro. In Foundations, blue-red is billed as draw 2/spells. And in Outlaws of Thunder Junction, it cared about casting your second spell, and that was paired with the plot mechanic. And I feel like a very clear thing for me about when blue-red flops is when it's themed around anything that asks its creatures to be small to start and grow over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a huge weakness. We've seen that, and I think that's been... I was thinking about this thing exactly actually yesterday while I was playing Turtles, which is that I'm attracted to this type of card, which is probably not a good quality. I mean, I guess, but like the Donatello Away with Machines, I think it is the 2 and a blue 1/2 flyer that grows whenever an artifact enters the battlefield. That's so small to start. And like green just gets to play Primordial Pachyderm, the 3 and a green 4/4 reach trample gain 2 life that takes no work and is already a 4/4 for one more mana. Like to me, those are when blue red struggles, when the other colors get just better cards at better rates and you're trying to do work to make your cards the same rate as other colors creatures.
I wonder if there's something to be thought about. I was thinking about this when I was looking at all these, you know, I had the 6 sets open and just pouring through all the card files. Is there something to be said about mechanics or cards even that relate to the mechanics that have static growth versus not necessarily exponential growth, but just they need to be on the battlefield for that growth to happen? And the 2 cards that I wanted to compare were First Time Flyer and Razzle Dazzler. So First Time Flyer was an avatar that's 1 and a blue for a 1/2 flyer that has +1/+1 if there's a lesson in your graveyard. Doesn't care about... Does it have to see you casting the lesson? Does it have to have the lesson in the yard when it's there and then it gets a +1/+1 counter? No, it's just static. Does it meet this requirement? You get this. Felt a lot better versus something like Razzle Dazzler, which is 1 and a blue for a 1/2. When you cast your second spell, it gets a counter. And so you're in this awkward, like, okay, how do I sequence around this thing to finally get this to grow? And yes, that can continue to grow, but that was not a card that mattered that much. But there is already a sort of wrench thrown into this comparison, which is Sahagin is a bit of an outlier in this respect. And Sahagin was one of the like, whoa, this is what this archetype does very well. And that's the 1 and a blue 1/3 from Final Fantasy that got a +1/+1 counter when you cast something with MV4 or greater, and it was unblockable. So this was like sort of your win condition in a lot of those decks.
Correct. And I think caught all of us by surprise, or certainly me. But I think rather than Sahagin being so good, I think it was surrounded by the stuff that made it good. You know what I mean? I think you could, much like context always matters, I think we could drop Sahagin into OTJ, and I don't think it's going to be particularly special there. And granted, the 4 mana value stuff was definitely designed for Finn or whatever, but I think Sahagin was surrounded by extremely good interaction.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. If we look at interaction, one of the ties that bind for me, okay, red removal. You know, red always gets this trio of removal, sort of small, medium, large. And in the sets where red performed well, and I'm not saying that this is always going to be the case, but it was worth noting, in Final Fantasy, Avatar, and Lorwyn, red gets a 1 mana removal spell that scales with the game. A 1 mana removal spell that can kill something for toughness or sometimes greater. We had Thunder Magic in Final Fantasy. We had Firebending Lesson in Avatar. And we had Cinder Strike in Lorwyn Eclipse. And Cinder Strike, probably, I mean, according to the data, the worst of the 3 removal spells from red. And I do think Cinder Strike has fallen in both of our estimations over the course of the format. We're very high on it. Still like the card quite a bit, but context matters with that card. The only set of the poor performing ones that got a card like that was Foundations getting Burst Lightning. But Burst Lightning couldn't really save Blue Red in that respect. And I think we can talk about why Blue Red fell flat in Foundation specifically. But that was one thing that stood out to me, was like, oh, all 3 of these archetypes get this extremely efficient, scalable removal spell at common.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that 1 mana removal spell does that we've talked about for blue red is sometimes it's asked to be tempo aggro, sometimes it's asked to be control, and a 1 mana spell like that scales with the game is an absolute banger in either deck, right? Lets you double spell while pushing threats in the cheaper deck, and in the control deck maybe lets you cast a card draw spell while removing a threat. Like it just opens up so many options for you for how you want to try to play the game.
The other thing that stood out to me about removal was that Man cannot live on bread alone. Blue red cannot survive on red removal alone. Blue's interaction, how good Blue's interaction was, really seemed to play a part. If you look at the Blue interaction in the worst performing archetypes, you're getting cards like Jailbreak Scheme in OTJ, which is like the top or bottom spell. It's got spree, but it's a sorcery. And so you're paying two and a blue to put a target artifact or creature on top or bottom of its owner's library. That is a sorcery speed play is really weak. You get something like Cryo Shatter in Edge of Eternities, which I think we all thought might be the unable to scream of its day, but it wasn't. This is a single blue aura. It gets -5/-0. And when it's tapped or dealt damage, you destroy it. These were just not very impactful cards in their format. And you could compare those to even something like Blossom Bind, which was extremely efficient. Didn't always get its man, but when it did, was very efficient as the one in a blue aura removal in Lorwyn. And something like Lost Days in Avatar The Last Airbender was just like, whoa, one of the best commons, full stop.
Well, sure. And another thing that's sticking out, I think, in these top sets is you mentioned Blossom Bind, and then in Final Fantasy, they're stuck in Summoner's Sanctum, two and a blue flash, enchant creature or artifact, taps it down, doesn't untap, activated abilities can't be activated. Is blue providing a complementary good spell that shuts down big creatures, right? Because that's where red struggles. Like blue red has a thing that can just, where green plays a 5/5 and you're like, well, crap, my red spells only deal 3 or 4. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so blue providing that complementary piece to not just fold to a large monster.
So interaction was the thing. It was interesting to me that I couldn't quite figure out like how counter magic played into things in terms of like, in good sets, the counter magic didn't matter sometimes. In bad sets, the counter magic was some of the better cards. There didn't seem to be any sort of, I can draw a conclusion from it. And almost all of these sets had the sort of the Holy Trinity, as you were describing earlier, the instant speed card draw plus interaction on board plus counterspell. But they're not all created equal, you know, like, It'll Quench You was good in Avatar, but that's partially because it's a lesson. Wild Unraveling, wildly, largely unplayed in Lorwyn Eclipsed. You got some really good counterspells in some of the bad sets. Like Refute was one of Blue's best commons in Foundations, the one blue-blue counterspell plus draw a card, discard a card. So not much that I could glean there. I do think that blue-red, and this sort of speaks to the spells matter of it all, blue-red performs best, I think, when it gets to be threat dense. I think the days of like your blue-red deck has 11 creatures are gone. And that is what really stuck out to me in the Foundations life. That when I was looking through the Foundations, I was like, so Foundations only gets one signpost in Balmor, Battlemage Captain. It's blue-red for a 1/3 flyer. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, creatures you control get +1/+0 and gain trample until end of turn. Great. Very clear signpost, strong, efficient creature. But when it's surrounded by either mopey creatures or just not enough creatures, this is a removal magnet. And then the rest of your deck kind of crumbles if it's not around.
Yeah, that I think is one of my biggest takeaways from all of this stuff that you put together is that right there. The building your deck around creature decks that are fewer creatures, and then the signpost being the linchpin of your deck. And then if your opponent can pick that off with an interaction spell, and then all of the rest of your cards are worse all of a sudden because you put all these enablers in for these few payoffs. And when those payoffs are tied to a few key creatures, you're just very easily disruptible. But I will say, I think it just depends on what types of payoffs they print, right? If they print another Rise from the Tides-esque card, or they print another Seize the Storm-esque card, all of a sudden, those high spell count decks, I mean, think about Lord of the Rings. Like, Lord of the Rings, you could have an insanely high spell count deck. But it just depends on how they design it, and we just haven't seen many of those designs recently in the Playbooster era.
Right. Well, the two cards you've just referenced, I think, are very interesting in that both Rise from the Tides and, was it Seize the Storm?
Mm-hmm.
The other one, that's the, it makes a, it's a red spell with flashback, and it makes a spell, or makes a creature token with power toughness equal to the number of instant sorceries in your graveyard and in exile. Those are both spells that affect the board. Those are both spells that create bodies on the battlefield for you. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing. You know, I'm looking through Foundations and I'm like, what spells make a creature? And it's like a 3-mana thing that makes 2/1/1 goblins. Like, you need stuff that's good. That was one of the reasons why blue-red was so good in War of the Spark. This is pre-play booster. But you had amass tokens. And so you have all these things that are like, I'm doing my spell matters stuff. I'm doing my instant and sorceries matter, but I'm affecting the board while I'm doing it. And that is a big difference between failure and success, I think, for this archetype.
For sure. That checks out with me.
Some other things that stuck out to me as like, ooh, does this matter? In all top three performing sets, all of the decks got a cheap protection spell. So in Final Fantasy, we had Magic Damper. Single blue, +1/+1, hexproof until end of turn. In Avatar, we got Octopus Form, basically the same card, but it's a lesson. And probably the worst of these, but still playable, in Lorwyn Eclipsed, we had Aquatect's Defenses, the one in a blue, flash aura, +1/+2, hexproof. I wonder if that supports the, maybe I'm slightly less threat dense, and so I need to protect my threats some more. Or what, just the fact that how tempo positive these plays are. But the fact that these three top sets got those effects and the three bottom sets seemingly did not stood out to me.
I mean, it definitely offers you the play pattern of, you know, take Final Fantasy, for example. Shantotto, Tactician Magician, which is one blue red for an uncommon 0/4. When you cast a non-creature spell, it gets +X/+0 until end of turn, where X is the amount of mana spent to cast that spell. If X is 4 or more, draw a card. That was one of the, if not the best, uncommon in payoff in the set. Mm-hmm. And just one games, if left on the battlefield, having that cheap protection spell allows you to set up play patterns where you wait a turn to stick your threat because you know it's going to be a removal magnet. So you wait till 4 to play your Shantotto, hold up your Magic Damper, your opponent's like, oh crap, I need to kill that. And you can almost anticipate your opponent firing off the removal spell because of how high value the target you present is. And yeah. I think that's certainly a valuable play pattern that it makes available when they're not in the set.
That's an interesting point that maybe there's something in tandem there of like, needs a powerful signpost. And we didn't really talk about the signpost in that way. A couple things stood out to me for signposts. One is just that, like, the OTJ one and the Edge of Eternity ones are these sort of small, you know, if you Menominon in Uthros Exile and EOE, which was 3 mana for a 1/3 flyer that grew with artifacts entering. Chrome Violent Cacophony was 4 mana for a 2/3 flyer that grew and drew cards as you cast your second spells. But on their own, I mean, even on curve on their own, they're just underwhelming and you really need to put in the work for them. And compare that to stuff like Shantotto, which is 3 mana for an 0/4, not exciting, but supported and protectable. Something like Dragonfly Swarm in Avatar, that was the *3 power equal to the number of instant or non-creature spells in your graveyard. Like, you know, you're getting these cards that don't, and Dragonfly Swarm, to my earlier point about it doesn't need, it's like the first time flyer. It doesn't need to see you casting those spells, double spelling, casting artifacts. And so you're not punished for top decking it as well. All of that, I think, is pieces of those puzzles.
Well, another thing that stands out to me just looking through those is in the top performing sets, two of them are not legendary. Like, right, they allow you to have multiple copies on the battlefield for your payoff stuff. Whereas in Enfin, Shantotto, all you really need is one. You just need a Shantotto to stick around, and it's powerful enough to absolutely take over the game. Whereas the other three in the bottom sets, Balmor, Battle Mage Captain, Chrome, and Menominon, in theory, you would want multiple of them on the battlefield to be seeing multiple spells cast, but you can't. And then once the first, like, so let's say you've got three copies in your deck or whatever, and once the first one gets picked off, the second one is so much worse because, like you said, they need to see the spells too. So I think them being legendary also hurts it a little bit there. Whereas in those sets where it's performing well, you just get multiple, you know, Eclipsed Flamekins, you get multiple Twin Flame Travelers, you get multiple Dragonfly Swarms.
I really want to. Every fiber of me wants to make fun of you for knocking cards for being legendary because that's your bit. But I think this is extremely insightful and correct.
Thank you.
Good assessment. Here's something else that stood out to me. There's a Man of War variant, a bounce plus that is in these sets and uncommon. Sometimes common in the case of OTJ. Basically, if these are like, you've got three of like the best uncommons in the set represented in the top sets and not so much. And they're not really even uncommons. They're commons in the bottom sets. So if we look at, we had Rhymekin Recluse in Lorwyn Eclipsed, 3-mana 3/2 bounce. We had Invasion Submersible in Avatar. That's the vehicle that bounced something.
3/3 bounce for 3-mana. 3/3
bounce. And it's a little bit of a stretch, but it is bounce plus. You had Eject in Final Fantasy, which is 3 and a blue. Return target non-land permanent to its owner's hand, draw a card, which was also important because it was synergistic for the color pair as a mana value for non-creature spell that also did this effect. And then in the other three sets, like the best of the bunch is honestly like Desculpting Blast from EOE, the 1 and a blue, bounce a thing, get a 1/1.
Big Fin Bouncer would like a word. Excuse me.
Big Fin Bouncer from Foundations was very good too. 3 and a blue, 3/2. And this was a common. Notably, you can't return anything. Return target creature an opponent controls to its owner's hand. And I do think a plus of these is being able to, in a pinch, rebuy ETBs, get something out from under a aura-based removal spell. And then OTJ had another common, which is Peerless Rope Master, 4 and a blue, 4/4. It enters and you return up to one target tapped creature to its owner's hand. So quite a bit worse than those options.
Significantly worse, because that basically means you can't be aggressive with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, to your point of, I mean, just like, not only are these are plays that are good no matter what the archetype is doing. If it's tempo aggro, great. If you're controlling, great. You love to have the board presence plus, you know, interact with your opponent's board type deal. So a two-way player, if you will. You know, one of the things that I want to be able to do from this episode is be like, and what will we be looking out for when we see new sets and try and figure out if these archetypes will succeed or not. But in the top performing blue-red decks, they all get Imperial Oath award-winning contenders, which I don't think is nothing. In Lorwyn Eclipsed, it gets 2 in Kolrath Zealot and Flamekin Guildweaver, the 6/5 in red and the 4/3 trample make a treasure in red. In Avatar, your boy the Koi, Giant Koi, is in there. The 5/7 waterbending 3 unblockable with island cycling. And in Final Fantasy, Call the Mountain Chocobo. The 3 and a red, make a 2/2 Choco, get a mountain with flashback for 5 and a red.
What a card. And also, speaking of the spells that affect the board, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Great point. Yeah. Which spells that affect the board, a double dip of a 4-mana value, you know, trigger for your things that care about that. Call the Mountain Chocobo really did it all. Didn't really see those cards when I was looking through Foundations and Outlaws and Edge of Eternities. What I did see in those three sets were a cycle of cards that was, as I'm naming, like target a creature cantrips. We had Fleeting Distraction, single blue, creature gets -1/-0 until end of turn, draw a card. Take the Fall, same deal, but if you control an outlaw, the thing gets -4/-0 instead. And Mental Modulation in EOE was 1 and a blue, tap target artifact or creature, draw a card, and it costs 1 less to cast during your turn. Those cards don't matter.
At all.
At all. But part of me, I think you're like, I'm predisposed to some other stuff. I am predisposed to look at this and go, ooh, a little, ooh, what does this button do? But these cards just don't matter at all. And to a broader point, I was expecting to see more opts, more blue cantrips, more single red creatures get trample, draw a card, whatever. They're either not present. They're certainly not present in the top performing sets. And again, I just feel like I'm like, oh, do these cards just not matter? And I think that's the case.
Well, but again, it's depending on what type of payoffs we get, right? Like if we get a payoff that cares about seeing 8 sorceries in your yard or whatever, then all of a sudden those cards are going to matter again.
I guess.
But the broader note is, even if that's a thing, if you're supposed to be drafting blue red in those styles of sets, you should be getting those cards for free. They mm-hmm. certainly are never going to be high picks.
Yeah. That was another thing I was looking at, was like, what is the cheap hand smoothing or cheap card draw effects that these sets get? And not a ton of conclusions to take from this, other than the like thrill of possibilities is out. Basically every set gets this effect in some form. Melded Moxite in EOE, Highway Robbery in OTJ, Thrill of Possibility in Foundations. Accumulate Wisdom is the sort of outlier in Avatar, because that actually was mattered. We didn't have it in Lorwyn Eclipsed. We had rummaging variants in Gristle Glutton and Flaring Cinder, but like this effect just doesn't really make or break this archetype in any way, and it often seems like these cards are not memorable.
Yeah, it breaks my heart to hear that. Pour one out for Thrill of Possibility in Theros Beyond Death, fueling your escape cards. That was, I think, maybe one of the last times that was great. But mm-hmm. one of the takeaways that you don't have in our notes that I see here is that all of the top sets get huge burst card draw spells that are great, that are not present in the bottom sets.
Yes. Yes, that is true. Though I don't know how much... I wonder what the correlation is there. Like, does unexpected assistances... presence, like when I think of blue red and Lorwyn Eclipsed, does unexpected assistance matter in that deck? When I think of Avatar, I do think Waterbending Lesson matters, and Accumulate Wisdom, or yes, I guess that's Accumulate Wisdom, the card I meant to say, which I always abandon attachments, is the cheap hand smoothing from Avatar that is, I think, another Thrill of Possibilities exception to the rule, but that's because it's hybrid, it's a lesson, etc. But Waterbending Lesson and Clues, I think the trio of Accumulate Wisdom, Waterbending Lesson, and Clues in Avatar did give Blue Red a boost there. And one of the best commons in Final Fantasy was Combat Tutorial.
I mean, I feel like blue getting, well, I don't think unexpected assistance necessarily helped Blue Red that much, but Blue Red did need access to card advantages. It's got it in different ways, so maybe not necessarily being tied up into a burst card draw spell, but just having access to powerful card advantage, I would think would be extremely helpful. And it does seem like that's a trend for the top sets.
Yes. Yes. I agree with that. So a lot of different like pieces of information, different pieces of data to be able to draw from. I have some sort of things that I was like, I think these are the things that I want to be on the lookout for if we're trying to assess archetype success in the future. And one of them is the total removal suite for the color pair. I think I'm going to be looking out for, does red give you something cheap that scales with the game? That seems to matter. And what does blue add? I think to your point, does blue add not only just good interaction full stop, but interaction that complements red's interaction? Like, how does blue deal with a big dumb green creature? Because that's where red might struggle.
Yep.
I think strong rate commons, like the Imperial Oaths in the color pair, which again, I feel like these are the hardest. Like, was I going to say that in preview season that Flamekin Guildweaver was going to be great?
No, there's no chance right?
that I'm going to know that. But if I ever can, if we ever can be like, ooh, this looks like a clunky looking overperformer. If that's in the color pair, I think that matters.
And speaking of being able to predict strong commons in that vein, this sounds kind of dumb, but I think one of the takeaways when I just look at this spreadsheet broadly, like if you just zoom out and don't like dive into specific categories and you just read the cards from the top three sets and you read the cards from the bottom three sets, I know what almost every single card does in the top three sets because they are good cards. And there are a lot of cards I had to click on in the bottom three sets because they're just not good Magic cards. And like a very service level takeaway from this for me is, well, when blue red gets good cards, it's going to be good. And when it does not get good cards, it really falls flat hard because its cards are a little finicky to begin with. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't just get to easily play to the board like some of the other color pairs.
So the hard-hitting journalism that we were known for is just really, really cracking down and bringing the big takes. No, but I agree with you that, like, I was trying to be like, is this recency bias? That, like, the top-performing blue-red sets are also some of the most recent sets we've had, and that's why I remember what all these cards do. But it's like, I'm going to remember what Watery Grasp does from Avatar because that was a surprisingly good card.
It was great.
And
yeah.
When I look at Stop Cold from OTJ, I'm like, what is that? Oh, this was a clunky 4-mana or a removal spell. What was its caveat? It tapped the thing. It loses all abilities, doesn't it? It's just like, okay. But it's 4-mana.
Well, that's the thing. It's the same card that we were shouting the praises out from Final Fantasy, but it's 4-mana versus 3-mana, which is a huge difference. That means you're basically only ever single spelling, whereas Stuck in Summoner Sanctum, paired along with stuff like Fire Magic, gives you good double spell turns.
Well, and to the point of context matters, but it doesn't really matter. Like, you might think, well, but do I need to knock Stuck in Summoner Sanctum because it's not 4-mana and this color pair cares about 4-mana value non-creatures? Like, no, you just want your interaction to be cheaper. You don't need it to be synergistic.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you know, the context, we talked about OTJ. OTJ is, I think, the poster child for green just getting extremely great rate cards, mm-hmm. and blue-red having to do work. And then your Stop Cold, your 4-mana thing, is barely keeping pace with what, like, you're not getting a mana advantage there. You're just stopping one of green's many 4/4s or 5/5s or 6/5s that are going to be beating your face in.
Well, blue-red just can't, maybe this is something to think about, like, blue-red can't do that. Like, if blue red's only way to interact with green is removal, you're just gonna run out. Like, if I have to use my, oh, this is my, like, catch all removal spell, I only have two of them, and I'm using it on your common 4/4, like, you just have no wiggle room for the bombs that are coming. Whereas when blue red gets the Kolrath Zealots and the Flamekin Guildweavers, now you're like, hey, my 4-mana 4/3 and my 6-mana 6/5 can tussle with your vanilla bodies on the ground, and then I can still save my removal for the bombs that matter.
Yeah.
Third takeaway, does the color pair leverage tempo? You know, the things that stuck out to me were the great mana wars that blue added, the great protection spells that blue added to those top performing archetypes. Those types of things I'm going to be on the lookout for. And I think the theme itself needs to support board presence and not, I don't know how to coin this, but not board presence where you need to see the stuff happening. Not board presence where it's like, if I'm around and then you cast an artifact, then I'll get big enough. I'm not into that. If it's static stuff like, hey, I just check how many spells are in the graveyard, no matter what. I don't have to see those spells hit the graveyard. I just check. That, I think, is a pretty big difference, and I hadn't categorized those two as that different before.
Yeah, I think that's a great takeaway.
Blue-red seems to be on the up and up. The returns of the past, whatever, three of the past four sets, blue-red a high-performing deck. We'll see how that continues for 2026. But that gives me hope, and I'm sure you're happy to see it as well. Though maybe you're not. Yeah. Maybe you'd rather blue-red be in the dumpster so you can pull it out from the depths.
No, those blue red was quite bad in those bottom sets that you pulled out. What I want to be happy, I don't care whether blue red is good or bad. I just want there to be a cursed recording type card in red. And one, I was thinking about this while I was making our 9 MTG cards that made me list, which is I feel really badly that I never did the thing from Start Your Engine set.
Did Push the Limit.
I did it a little bit, but like it was right there for me. And I dropped the ball on that one. I fumbled hard. That should have been my card and it was not.
God, Push the Limit was so sweet. This was a project that excited me. I'm curious to hear what folks think. And if we continue on with this throughout the year, and if you have feedback about like, hey, you could look at this category or look at a color pair like this, or I would have been interested to hear blah, like, I'm open to any and all feedback about categories of things to look out for future color pairs.
Sweet. All right. Sounds like a great place to wrap us up. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all of our content on our website at lordsoflimited.com. There's links to our episode backlog, our YouTube channel, our Twitch streams, respectively. You can find our merch and our Patreon page if you want to check that out. All available at lordsoflimited.com.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.